we have with us live in the studios this morning. John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with local, and it looks like Seattle finally has a new police chief.
Yes, they do.
Well, not new. Well,
yes, we do. Not new. No, you're right, Job. It's not a new police chief. It's
a retread.
It's the interim police chief who will become the new confirmed police chief. Mayor Mike McGinn finally announced his pick for the spot, and instead of bringing in the outsider, a very good candidate from East Palo Alto, he decided on John Diaz, the current interim chief, as the new Seattle Police Department chief. And it's interesting. I looked at that and I said, you know, it looks to me like he just caved completely to the downtown business interests as represented on the city council by Tim Burgess, who's the head of the public safety chair on the city council, which oversees the police department.
And who is widely assumed to be running against McGinn in 3 years.
Yeah, and Sally Bagshaw, who also sits on that committee, who has all along been kind of the mouthpiece of the Downtown Business Association and who was very vocal about how she did not like the candidate Ron Davis from East Palo Alto, because he would be an outsider coming in and trying to reform the department, and it would not be the status quo. He would shake up the status quo.
I think she managed to get all the way through the description of him without once using the word uppity, so she deserves credit for that.
Yeah. So I was really disappointed to see that. And you know, they use the excuse that Davis was running a small town police department operation in East Palo Alto, but he comes out of the Oakland Police Department originally, so he's very familiar with the problems of a large city. And East Palo Alto had a lot of big city crime problems there. I mean, it was considered the murder capital of the U.S., and he completely turned that around. So yeah, he would have been a good, really good candidate.
Yeah, being the police chief of East Palo Alto is very similar in terms of demographics and in terms of its setting to being the police chief of the south end of Seattle.
Yeah.
It has the urban setting. It's basically, you know, in the San Jose area, but it's an impoverished area near an affluent area that happens to be in another jurisdiction. And Davis cleaned that up. And what the hiring of Diaz says, mm-hmm. and it says this most clearly to non-white and immigrant communities in the Seattle area, is the status quo is acceptable. That treating police officers with impunity when they physically or verbally abuse suspects and citizens, that's okay. That's acceptable.
Yeah,
in the Seattle Police Department, and it's a terrible message to send.
Yeah, and Davis, when he was in, you know, Davis, when he took on the job at East Palo Alto, there was a big divide between the police department and the local communities of color, and he turned that around too. And that's something that we need here in Seattle, and I just don't see it happening under Diaz. Tellingly, the person who works probably as most closely, because I don't know the absolute details of his job, but a person who works very closely with him would be the city attorney. And in this case, the city attorney, Pete Holmes, came out and said that this police department needs an outsider and that he was extremely concerned that Diaz might be named police chief. Of course, McGinn met with him after he made the announcement and said, you know, you got to buckle down and work with this guy, and Holmes agreed. But that really told me that Diaz is not the best candidate.
Yeah, it's very, very unfortunate.
All right. Moving on, big update this week in regards to Referendum 71.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
Okay. The United States Supreme Court ruled 8-1 this week, which you know it's a pretty compelling case when even the conservatives on the Supreme Court are going along with it. They upheld the Washington Public Records Act. This was the case that came out of Referendum 71 with its conservatives backers last year wanting to keep secret the signatures on the petitions that were used to qualify the initiative, the referendum onto the ballot, claiming
and
that
Referendum 71 was about protecting folks who are in gay couples and allowing them to have the same benefits as people who are married, right?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. correct. And the argument of the backers was that because this is a controversial measure, and because when similar measures were on the ballot in California, it was used by pro-gay activists to allegedly harass people who had financially backed the initiative, and they were concerned that the same thing would happen to petition signers here. The Ninth Circuit the U.S. District Court for the West Coast ruled that they did not have a case, and the Washington Public Records Act trumped their need for secrecy. That went to the Supreme Court on both a broad and a narrow issue. The broad issue is whether petition signatures for initiatives and referendum are public records and therefore subject to public records laws. And then the narrow issue was whether in this particular case the referendum backers had compelling a reason to fear for the security of signers. On the broad issue, the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 against it. Against the backers, saying that the public records law is and the public interest in having those records be public took priority, and on the narrow interest, they sent it back to the Ninth Circuit. But five of the nine Supreme Court justices signaled that were it to come before them on the narrow interest, they would probably rule against on that too. So really, a pretty convincing smackdown, but. The problem with this, it's good news in the sense that it did not set a very bad precedent for a future initiative and referendum signers and efforts. But the bad news is that referendum 71 people got exactly what they wanted in this case, which is they wanted to protect the privacy of their signers all the way through the process of its appearing on the ballot. And by tying this up in court, they managed to successfully do that.
Yeah, and for months afterwards.
Yeah.
It's the signatures still have not been made public, and they may not be soon. We'll see.
All right. Moving on, a important case related to the tunnel.
Yeah, in a transportation decision, the federal judge John Kugenhauer ruled that the group Citizens Against the Tunnel, folks who are opposing the construction of the downtown traffic tunnel to replace the viaduct, that their case was that they did not have grounds to sue to stop the construction of the tunnel because the state had and federal government had allowed the construction to go forward without environmental impact statements on all phases of the construction. The judge decided, well, you know, these are just concerned citizens. Concerned citizens don't have standing in his court as far as trying to sue to halt the construction of a project when no environmental impact statement has been issued. And so he threw their case out, which I found very interesting. It means, of course, that just because you live in Seattle and just because you are a concerned citizen and you care about the state of your environment, that you don't have standing unless you can prove some kind of economic interest. That's where the lawsuit stands at this point. So the south phase of the construction of the tunnel is set to go ahead and start next month. So I just don't see anything else coming down the pipe that's going to delay it.
All right. Moving on, big protest this last week regarding immigration rights.
Yeah, on Wednesday, 23 people from a couple of different pro-immigration reform groups were arrested as part of a protest in front of the federal building. Now, this was done during the day, during the build-up to an afternoon Mariners game, and the idea behind going out in the street during this time was the area is already under gridlock. You don't have a lot of disruption to traffic that isn't going to be moving anyway, and at the same time, you have a captive audience that can see what you're doing. And we saw all credit to the people who risked arrest for this, but the whole rationale behind acts of civil disobedience or civil resistance is you feel so strongly about an issue that you are willing to risk the inconvenience and possible penalties to yourself up to and possibly including jail time in order to make a point because you feel morally and politically compelled to make this statement. And we see why these types of civil disobedience actions are rarer and rarer these days, because you cannot make that case to the public if the media doesn't play along. And by playing along, I mean actually reporting the story and reporting why it is that, you know, at least the issue that you're making the case. The media coverage of this by local media was absolutely dreadful. The television stations, one of them actually reported it in the context of, not you know, not mentioning why people were doing the protests, but mentioning that they were preventing you, that is, yes, you, from getting home. You know, the Seattle Times, our alleged newspaper of record, ran a 7-sentence AP story on it that mentioned it, that the protest was about immigration, but didn't particularly mention what about immigration these people were concerned about, which, you know, could be anything.
Maybe, which side of the...
Maybe they just want to shoot everybody who comes across the border. It's really hard to tell.
Yeah.
You know, it really, under circumstances like that, you know, it really makes it very difficult for those types of protests to be effective. And it very much is a political statement by the media institutions that are covering it, because by refusing to report the news and refusing to actually identify what's motivating people to take the action, you're taking sides in that dispute. And that's a very unfortunate tendency that we've seen more and more in media coverage and in local media over the past several years, and was very much on full display this week.
All right. Moves us on then to national and this week's update on the growing oil disaster in the Gulf.
Yeah, this week a judge, U.S. District Court Judge Martin Feldman, lifted a 6-month moratorium on new drilling in the Gulf. Of course,
wasn't he Igor in Young Frankenstein?
Yeah, Marty Feldman. But no, he lifted the 6-month moratorium. I need to point out right now, though, that the moratorium was not really a moratorium. It was a partial ban, and you really can't even call it a partial ban when, as we know, the Minerals Management Service continued to rubber stamp permits for drilling in the Gulf, regardless of
Obama's announcement. They were just giving waivers for every everything that came down the pike.
Yeah, so. Everything that came along.
So there really was no moratorium in the first place, and this was again portrayed in the media as a reversal of policy that wasn't reversed.
Yeah, and oh, isn't this horrible and everything? And I found that kind of humorous when I read it, thinking, what are you talking about? You know, you haven't been all up in arms about the fact that the drilling is continuing and that the Minerals Management Service is back to business as usual in spite of Obama's announcement that he was going to clean things up there.
Yeah, well, not only haven't been up in arms about it, they haven't even reported it by and large.
Yeah, really. And so it was interesting. I mean, the articles reported that Feldman held investments in at least 8 oil company and oil service companies, or funds that invested in them, including Transocean, which owned the oil rig that sank. But they didn't report that, oh gosh, you know, here are these guys at the Minerals Management Service continuing to allow companies to drill, even, you know, as Obama is insisting that there was this moratorium in place.
The other part that was amusing about that in regard to Feldman was reporting that he actually sold his holdings in the 8 different energy companies this month, as though that absolved him of any conflict of interest.
Yeah, it's almost as if he was like clearing out his portfolio so that he could rule on this case.
And what do you want to bet that once the case is passed, he's going to buy those stocks again?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, and you know, they're going to be at value price here in a little while. You know, as the oil spill continues to grow, energy stocks may be a real bargain in terms of investors, how investors feel about them. Anyway.
All right. Moving on then to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the economic news. A couple of interesting stories. One that just broke overnight, the Dodd-Frank bill, the reconciled financial reform bill, as everyone knows, hopefully. Both the House and Senate passed their own versions, and they've been sitting down in the Reconciliation Committee trying to make those two versions agree. And the bill just overnight passed out of the reconciliation process, and early this next week will start through the House and Senate again to be approved and then go to Obama for signature. What was interesting, I mean, it's still early days, so we don't know exactly what the language looks like for a lot of the bill, but some things are very clear. The Volcker Rule survived. That's Paul Volcker's proposal that banks be limited in what they can do with their own capital, that they not be allowed to do what is called proprietary trading, which is use their capital to do trading to make their own profit rather than work on the behalf of their clients. What didn't survive in any kind of recognizable form was Senator Blanche Lincoln's proposal to regulate derivatives trading. That was very heavily watered down, and this next week we'll see exactly how watered down it was, but it seems pretty clear that the number of derivatives that will be regulated on an exchange are very small compared to what she had initially proposed. What the bill does too is it gives a lot of power to the Fed and the SEC. It turns them into the main regulators. And as we know, the Fed and the SEC are a revolving door for industry types because, that's where they draw their staff. There's no real oversight of these agencies and they have conflicting interests.
The other piece of that's important to note is that the whole framework of this is that rather than banning practices outright, it gave the Fed and the SEC authority to regulate them. But the problem with that is that if there's no will at the SEC or the Fed to regulate these practices, and that can either be because of the revolving door of who's on those regulatory bodies in the first place, or it can be because of the larger executive branch. If you had President Bush for 8 years, staffing his various agencies with people who had absolutely no interest in enforcing any of the rules that were actually on the book, then it doesn't matter what the rules are. It doesn't matter what the laws are.
Exactly.
If they're not enforced.
Exactly. The Fed and the SEC can only be as strong as the people who are appointed, and they can only really follow the policy of whoever is president. And as we've seen over the last 8 years, the person who was president laid down a policy of no regulation, and that was the main problem. If you don't have rules on the books, as Jobs says, that prohibit certain acts, then you're just, it's open to interpretation and it's open to whoever is running the show. And that's what this bill will ensure. And essentially what we see in this bill is Congress caving to the banking lobby and the financial services industry. They said they made senators and representatives feel like they didn't understand the financial rules that were included in the bill. They put enough doubt in congressmen's minds so that they finally watered down the rules enough and just basically turned over the job to the SEC and the Fed, and that's really unfortunate.
All right. And
some other economic news. Yeah, mm-hmm. We had some reports on the state of the housing market this week that I found were very interesting, that give us a pretty good broad look at what's going on in the housing market. Usually these reports come out separately, so you don't get a big picture like you do this week, but this week we did. First, the report on the sales of existing homes showed that they fell in May. This was very significant because the report that measures the sales of existing homes looks at houses that it measures the houses that closed in May. Now, the tax credit for the home buyer tax credit was supposed to be good through April 30th, which means any contracts that were initiated before April 30th but didn't close until June, till the end of June, would have qualified for the home buyer's credit. So everyone expected the number that measured the sales of existing homes to continue on an upswing through June, through at least mid-June. But we saw it fall in May, which just goes to show that perhaps even the home buyer's credit wasn't really stimulating the housing market enough. And then to sort of prove that point, a report on the sales of new homes showed a dramatic fall of 33% over the prior month. That's the largest monthly drop on record since they started keeping track of this statistic in 1963. That's a real indication of the impact of the expiring credit, because the sales of new homes doesn't measure closing. It measures contracts, so people entering contracts to buy new homes dropped by at least a third in May after the home buyer's credit expired in April. So that's going to show you exactly what is happening to the housing market without that one little piece of stimulus going. Also, we saw this week that mortgage rates are the lowest that they've been since the 1950s. They're now down to about 4.69%. But has that helped to spark people to buy? Well, no. Refinancings right now are about half the level of what they were early last year, when mortgage interest rates were almost as low. So it's really proven that anybody who could refinance already has. And what we saw in a report by the Office of Thrift Supervision is that half of all homeowners with modified mortgages are at least 2 months behind on their payments, meaning they're heading towards bankruptcy. That's half of all people who have received some kind of modification from the bank. But if you look at what those modifications are, they're really, the bulk of them are really refinancings. What the report showed was that when banks engage in a modification, about 86% of the time what they're doing is they're just lowering the interest rate on the loan. They're not doing anything else. And about half of those, they may make an extension of the term of the loan. So they may, instead of calling it a 30-year loan, they may call it a 40-year loan. But when you look at it, are banks really taking a write down in the principal? Well, no. When it comes to loan modifications, in less than 2% of the loans, banks actually write off the principal. That's shocking. And what it is telling us is that in the coming months, if half of all those mortgages are headed towards bankruptcy, those mostly being refinance mortgages, what it's showing us is that later this year, banks are going to have to start writing down the principal, or people are going to be walking away in record numbers. So that's giving you a big picture of the state of the housing market, and it is not good.
All right. Moving on. Big vote came up this week regarding state Medicare, Medicaid, and unemployment.
Yeah, this has been an interesting month in terms of seeing exactly who the Republicans in Congress represent. They represent oil companies because they apologize for them. They represent big business, basically, and they've been very unapologetic about it. Republicans in the Senate this week successfully filibustered to kill a bill, a financial package that would have given desperately needed aid to state and state Medicare programs, or state Medicaid programs, rather, preventing a 21% cut in reimbursement rates to doctors taking patients who receive Medicare, that is disabled and senior patients, giving an additional extension to people who have been chronically long-term unemployed, which is at record levels right now. The number of people who have been looking for work for really a year or two and have not been able to find any work. That bill had 58 votes, but that was short of the 60 votes that was needed to close off the filibuster, and therefore those unemployment benefits won't be extended, and those Medicare patients won't be seen by a number of doctors who won't be willing to take the lower rates right now, and so on and so forth. That the actions of the Republicans in the Senate are going to hurt a lot of ordinary people in this country over the coming months and years, unless the Democrats can find a way to get around that and ameliorate some of those issues. Now the rationale for this has been Republicans not wanting to add to the existing federal debt with government spending, but they don't seem to have any qualms about doing that when it comes to throwing money down the rat hole that are the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you can see where people are willing to spend the money. They're willing to spend it on big corporations that supply fancy weapons to the military, but they're not willing to spend it on ordinary people who need help.
All right. And briefly, a new GAO report out?
Yeah, GAO, the investigative arm of Congress, came out with a report this week that essentially vindicated ACORN and found that there were no problems with the, or no significant problems anyway. There were a few minor reporting issues on one of the contracts, but of the eight contracts that the federal government had with ACORN in terms of voter registration, the ACORN did its job just fine. The problem, of course, is that all of the various allegations that have been made by conservative activists regarding ACORN over the past year have essentially destroyed the organization. They've closed all of their regional offices. They've lost their federal contracts. And we've seen this now as a real pattern. We saw it also with ClimateGate, where the emails that were leaked that climate change deniers were using to bring into question the science around climate change last December, that those allegations again turned out to be entirely spurious. But what conservative activists have discovered and have been taking advantage of and exploiting is the tendency of modern media to quote unquote report both sides of an issue without making any attempts whatsoever to verify the actual accuracy and truthfulness of the claims on each side of an issue, so that you can say something that is totally spurious and totally illegitimate, in this case that ACORN committed massive voter fraud, And even though it's not true, by the time it comes out that it's not true, the damage has been done. You've made your point, and the public has moved on to whatever the next story is. It's a really, really dangerous tendency that can be used by demagogues to manipulate things in very scary ways, and we're going to see more of it.
Yeah, especially with the eagerness of the media to report whatever is internet news as the real news without checking their facts first.
All right. And finally, it appears that the U.S. has a new general in Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah. We're not going to talk a whole lot about the sort of internal dynamics of the Obama administration and their personnel shufflings, but General Stanley McChrystal shuffled off the stage to be replaced by his boss, General Petraeus, in pursuing the war in Afghanistan. What is really at issue here, I think, is, as Jobs said earlier, it's not so much the change in personnel, it's the change in policy that's important here, and the Obama administration did exactly the opposite of what was needed. They changed the personnel rather than changing the policy.
Yeah. In fact, Obama said those exact words. He said the personnel are changing, but the policy remains the same. That is the problem. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting was all this brouhaha that erupted over a Rolling Stone story that was a profile of McChrystal. And, you know, what McChrystal thinks of his bosses or his civilian leadership, you know, who cares about that? He's not the first general, nor will he be the last, that has strong opinions about the people he works with. You expect that out of those sorts of personalities. But what is important out of that Rolling Stone article was that it made a very strong case that the war in Afghanistan, I almost said Iraq, I can't imagine why the two would blur together, but the war in Afghanistan is not winnable, period. That should have been the takeaway, and that should have been the scandal from the story. But for some reason, our media and our political apparatus can't even bring themselves to discuss that as a possibility, even though it's dreadfully apparent to anybody who's actually paying attention to what's going on the ground.
Yeah, and in fact, what's going on in Pakistan is they are preparing for the fact that the war in Afghanistan is not winnable by the U.S., that the U.S. has set a deadline to withdraw troops, and they're going to be gone, leaving Pakistan with the mess in a neighboring country to have to deal with and clean up. And so they've been sending their head of their military and of their interior ministry over to Afghanistan this week in shuttle diplomacy to try to sit down with Karzai behind closed doors without the U.S. present to talk about how Karzai is going to have to reconcile with the Taliban. And, of course, Pakistan prefers that he reconcile with the Taliban that they support, which is the Haqqani network, the guys that they sit down and meet with on a regular basis. And that's been going on pretty much, you know, for the last week or two. Pakistan sort of said, okay, well, you know, the Obama administration is going to be getting out of this soon, so we'd better take charge. And we know that the war in Afghanistan is not winnable. And what really is interesting to me is that the Obama administration has not sat down and said, well, you know, since we're financing both sides in the war, why don't we just declare victory and go home? You know, it's very clear to me that they might as well say, gosh, you know, we've won. It's time to bring the guys home. Stop pouring money down that rat hole.
Yeah, the good news is that the United States has been backing the winning side in the war in Afghanistan. The bad news is that winning side has been shooting at American troops.
Yeah, and it's time to bring them home.
All right, events?
Yeah, the big event this week is Gay Pride Weekend. The Pride Parade will be tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, starting at Westlake Park and marching down to Seattle Center, and then there will be a festival afternoon at Seattle Center. It's a party. Check it out.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's last regularly scheduled print issue came out this week. It's a end of an era and beginning of an era, because while you can get those collector's items, we also have a brand new website up and running. So you can find, at least for this issue and in the future for election issues and endorsement issues and other special events, we will continue to be doing occasional print issues. You can find that at bookstores and cafes and where you find free publications, King County Libraries system, etc. But always and continually updated, you can find the web edition at www.eatthestate.org.
The new web edition.
The new web edition. And the new blog.